Welcome to the Shiloh podcast. My guest today is Professor Lisa Oakley, who's been working on the subject of spiritual abuse for over 20 years, and tonight is giving her inaugural professorial address on Silence Isn't Golden, addressing abuse in religious contexts through partnership working. She's been in the Department of Psychology at the University of Chester for over 6 years. And Lisa, thank you for joining us ahead of your lecture this evening. How are you feeling about it?
I am feeling, as most people would be at this point in time, slight trepidation and nervousness, but also it's an amazing privilege, I think, to be able to share some of the work that we've done over the last 21 years. I think working alongside those who've experienced harm and then finding ways to ensure that those experiences are recorded well through good quality research and shared and then make a difference in training and practice is a huge privilege. So I'm hoping that I can get some of that across tonight.
21 years is a long time. How did you get into the subject? You did your PhD on spiritual abuse. So what took you into that?
So I'm a Christian. That's my faith background. And I had an experience. And after that, I went to try and read about that experience and was reading books in America, mainly. There wasn't really anything here that were talking about something called spiritual abuse that I'd never heard of. But as a psychologist, I am a both developmental and a social psychologist, and I was really interested in what I was reading, but I recognised that we weren't really talking about it here, and that we weren't really researching it. And so that led me to deciding to do that as my PhD study, wanting to recognise that I had an experience, but wanting to understand much more about other experiences that other people had had, and then wanting to build an evidence base for which to be able to understand this much better.
Can you say just something very briefly about the experience that you and others had, which you were needing the term spiritual abuse for?
So I suppose I wouldn't say, I don't talk lots about my own experience, but I think what I have learned over a period of time is that there simply wasn't the language to describe coercion and control with a kind of religious rationale and religious justification. And everything that I read in statutory definitions at that point might have some similarities. And certainly when the domestic abuse definition became to include coercive control, I could see elements of coercive control, but that is within a very specific interfamilial or interpartnership relationship, which isn't how the experiences that I've looked at occur. And so I think there wasn't a language to describe those experiences. And I think there was a need to first of all, to understand what they were, what do they look like, what are the characteristics of them, to try and map out what a process through that journey might look like, but also to then try and work on, well, how do we define this and what do we ultimately call this? It's certainly been a journey. I mean, one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is that the terminology has been and still is to some extent controversial. And certainly in 2018, when we published some research, there was quite a lot, particularly within the Christian press, where people were saying, is this terminology fit for purpose? Is it useful? Is it helpful? Should we be using it at all? I think over the course of doing the work that we've done, very clearly people have said that this is a really helpful terminology to talk about what's happened to them.
You're using the term we, so I'm wondering who were the people that you found early on in your research who sort of kept you company and did the work alongside you?
So I suppose at the very beginning, obviously I was doing my PhD, so that was me doing that, but obviously I had a supervisory team around me. My starting point was actually listening to narrative accounts from people who had had those experiences, and then doing some analysis of those to say, well, what are the key points of this? I think as the journey has progressed, I've worked quite closely with Justin Humphreys and 31.8, and we did some research together in 2018.
That's a safeguarding organisation.
That's right, yes. I worked with my PhD supervisor, Dr. Catherine Kinmond. We did a church experience survey in 2015. And in that survey, we asked some questions about control and coercion. And then in 2018, we did a follow-on piece, probably 2016, we published in 2018. We did a follow-on piece of research, which was specifically on spiritual abuse in Christian faith communities. And over 1,500 people completed that, 1,002 of whom said, I've had this experience.
Could you say something about what that experience is? I mean, it's got to be obviously in very general terms.
So we talk about it as a form of emotional and psychological abuse, which is characterised by a systematic pattern of controlling coercive behaviour within a religious context or with a religious rationale or justification. So we might see things like sacred texts or teaching being used to exercise control. We might see the use of something like God as complicit in the behaviour that is happening. We might see the use of divine position. So God has put me here and therefore you can't question me. You must do what you're asked to do. We do see a lot of use of what I call sort of, obviously most of my work's in the Christian faith tradition, biblical discourses. So discourses on things like unity, meaning, well, you can't speak out if something is happening to you of concern. And so there's lots of things that we see. We see enforced accountability, so not really having autonomy or choice. But again, that might be equated to your relationship with God or how good a Christian you are in that context. And so it can be very difficult for people to unpack what's happening to them and to be able to identify that when some of what is there in that context is things that they will be naturally hearing about, things like unity, which can be great and really good, but if it's used to control, can be harmful.
Or teaching, well, if you think about a couple of teachings like service or humility or all those things that Christians can be taught about quite properly, but then used in a coercive way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things we try and differentiate in the work is to say some of these teachings, you know, they're mainstream teachings, but it's how they're used. And if they're used to control and coerce, I think if you think about teachings on sacrifice, if that becomes therefore you need to spend all of your time here and you need not to be able to put any boundaries around yourself and what's acceptable and what isn't, then that's where we start to see some of that control coming in. And I think just even in talking about it, it really helps people to start to think about what's really good in the context that they're in and whether there are any things which are difficult. And we've developed now something called a fruit polo, well, people call it my fruit polo spectrum, but where we talk about really good, healthy behaviour at one end, going into unhelpful behaviour that we all do from time to time. We might not communicate very well and we might upset someone in the process, and then we can usually recognise that, address it and move ourselves back down. But then if we start to go up the spectrum further, we might see patterns of controlling coercive behaviour beginning to emerge where people might be scared to raise an issue. So we often see that in spiritual abuse where people don't feel able to raise an issue or ask a question because that is seen as a criticism or seen as negative, not something that you should be doing. But from a psychological point of view, we know actually asking questions is a really important thing. And so we see some of those characteristics and if we go all the way up, then we cross a threshold into emotional and psychological abuse, and we see highly consistent patterns of controlling coercive behaviour with that religious rationale or justification, then it can meet that category and criteria for spiritual abuse.
You've mentioned that there's some pushback against this, using the term spiritual abuse. I mean, I suppose it can be a very wide category, can't it? What challenges does that present to you?
I think it does present challenges. And I think actually some of, and I'm going to say this tonight, but some of the people who have asked or have said they don't think the term is fit for purpose or perhaps not that useful, I think some of that has led us to reflect on how we define this and how we talk about it, and certainly led to us reflecting on we need to be able to identify the key characteristics here. So if in any other form of harm, we would be looking for identifiers and indicators of what people would be looking for. And so that has led us to also do that within spiritual abuse.
So you'd be looking for evidence of harm done?
We'd be looking for evidence of coercion and control, definitely. We would be looking for that to be, there to be some kind of religious rationale or justification for that. Because one of the things, and this is a really valid point, which is why people sort of asking questions about your work is a good thing. Because people have said, what's the difference between psychological abuse and spiritual abuse? What's the difference between bullying and spiritual abuse? And I think those are really important questions. So the thing I think that makes this distinctive is the way in which people are controlled and coerced and the avenues and the pathways into that. So I think the use of sacred texts can be one of those, but equally it might be values that might be used to control people's behaviour that are part of your religious and context that you're in. And so actually you can, I think one of the critiques has been perhaps this is an area that would be difficult for somebody who wasn't part of a faith tradition to feel comfortable in working with it. And I think that's a right and proper concern. But I think what the way that I would answer that is that we already have the definition of psychological and emotional abuse, so we know what that is. And then when we start to say, here are some characteristics that you might find in people's experiences of those things, then people start to be able to identify, yes, this person was told that God was complicit in what was happening to them. That, you know, clearly teaching was used. You don't need to be a theologian to be able to see that teaching was used as part of a means of control. So I think it's really valid, and I think it's an ongoing debate that's going to continue. But what I do think is really important is recognising that people have been harmed, and the discussion about terminology not being something that stops us from addressing harm that's happened to people.
When you're talking, considering the perpetrators of spiritual abuse, are we always, well, I guess we're always talking about individuals, but we're also talking about systems and institutions, and that must be a difficult one when you're trying to call it out or call for accountability.
I think that's a really important question. So I often say that you could have someone, or actually more than one person, who is behaving in this way in what is otherwise a relatively healthy context, or you might have a whole culture that is very controlling. And so there are different ways in which this presents, and it does present challenges. I mean, if you are in a very controlled environment, it's very difficult to speak out in that environment just generally. But equally, if you're in an interaction with somebody, a relationship with somebody where spiritual abuse is happening, it will be very difficult to speak out about that. And actually, one of the reasons why I think this work is so important is because where do you go to speak out? It's very difficult to speak out within the context where your harm is happening. Mm. It's actually quite difficult to speak out even potentially in the broader faith context. And then if you want to speak out outside of that, are you going to be understood in terms of what has happened to you? And so it does make it a very difficult situation, whereas if you had experienced a different form of harm, there might be far greater public understanding. And that's why I think the work is important, because people who experience this kind of harm deserve to be responded to just as effectively as any other form of harm and abuse.
One of the pieces of research you're doing is with survivors, and you've asked them to draw pictures or present a piece of music which tells you about their experience. Can you tell me a little bit about what some of them are telling you?
Yeah, so that piece of work is looking at experiences of disclosure or non-disclosure, and it's not solely focused on spiritual abuse. It is any form of harm or abuse that people might have experienced. But the reason for doing the research the way that we did is because these kind of visual methods are a very different way to do research. They are very much, the ethos behind them is that they give much more power, control and autonomy to the person taking part. So rather than you turning up to an interview and I've already decided the questions, you can give somebody broad areas and then they can bring something that represents what they think is important, what's been important in their experience. And so that is part of the rationale for doing it. It is also that it leaves it open to people to be able to say, these are the important things and actually you've not asked me anything about those. And so some of the themes that are coming out, there's a whole variety of them, and we're really grateful to the people because it does take time for people to do that kind of work. But people have talked about the vulnerability of disclosure. So what it feels like when you come to the point of disclosure. So one person has chosen a picture of a tree with roots exposed and said, when you come to share your experience with somebody, you feel like the roots of your tree are exposed. Someone else has got a pair of keys that they're handing over, like the keys to the house, and you're not sure what someone's going to do with that story when you give it to them. There's a huge amount of vulnerability, and I think that is really powerfully told in those stories. I think that there's also quite a big theme around processes. So in some people's experiences, there just wasn't a process to take their account forward. In other people, it was an internal process, so you took it back in, and then it sometimes it then nothing, no action was taken for other people, there was a process, but it wasn't followed, or the process itself was quite damaging. And actually, a number of people have talked about being more traumatised by the process. And so I think that comes through very clearly in some of what we're seeing. And we're also seeing pictures, a number of pictures around silence and secrecy. And so when you come to, so reasons why you might not feel able to share. And actually, just going back to what we said earlier, one of the pictures somebody's chosen is a Bible on a dinner plate. And it's the verse that's circled is "Love keeps no record of wrongs," which was, in their experience, something that meant that they couldn't speak out.
It's an interesting image, that. What was interesting about it was the dinner plate and the knife and fork. Why the knife and fork and the dinner plate? Force feeding, or?
Yes, absolutely that. So the person actually, and interestingly, we didn't ask anybody to name any of their images. Many people did. And this one is called Eat the Words. And the person who did that said that they were force-fed scripture. And actually, later in their interview, they talk about the fact they're now learning to engage with it as a healthy meal. So the visual imagery is really, really strong.
In the lecture, you have a sort of flow chart which takes us through the process of spiritual abuse, how it happens. Can you just talk us through that very briefly?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say about that is we want to do a lot more work on it. So so some people have said, oh, there are other processes, and so that's probably the next thing that I want to do. But in that diagram, many people talked about having a very positive initial experience, which in and of itself is a good thing. But then experiencing a catalyst, I call it, where perhaps there's a controlling incident which just makes them question, you know, what am I part of here? And then they're given a very positive explanation for what's happened, and then there's a recommitment. And that process of controlling behaviour followed by positive explanation followed by recommitment can happen in a cycle for quite some time. And then often there is what I call a final catalyst, which might be a very small example of control, but where somebody almost, it's the thing that makes them think this situation is harmful, and it's the thing that makes them think they can't stay anymore. Now, sometimes people will exit then and they will leave. One person talked about the fact that people who leave situations of spiritual abuse often walk a lonely, misunderstood road because they don't know who to speak to about those experiences. And when we weren't talking about it at all, there was absolutely nowhere to go with that. Some people will stay because actually it's very too difficult to leave, and sometimes the person perpetrating the harm will leave. And then we see a whole raft of long-term impacts for people, including distrust. It's really difficult to trust if your trust has been broken. One person in my very first piece of work talked about being unsafe in a safe place, and then you don't know what's safe and who's safe. And then other impacts on self and identity, your faith and belief, and that sort of sense of being able to trust yourself where you've experienced control and then you've been given a positive explanation and then you've recommitted can make you start to doubt your own ability to see situations as they actually are.
What have you learnt along the way about the process of involving survivors in your research?
I think that I have learnt so much. I mean, I think that I've learnt just how emotionally costly for people it is to take part in research. And when I've been in meetings where survivors have been there, often they're the least well-paid people in the rooms. And over the last few years particularly, that has become something that I have thought more and more about. And so in the research that we have done recently, one of my caveats for being involved in that was that we would pay survivors to be co-designers on the project, and we would pay them properly. That we would pay people, it's a voucher payment, but pay people who were taking part in the research, that we would offer, that if they wanted to bring somebody to an interview, that we would pay for that. That we put support organisations in place, and part of the grant bid was also to pay for that. And also, as I've said, to give people the opportunity to do whatever they is right for them to debrief after taking part.
So it's about recognising the cost and the time, but you also mention the word co-design?
Yeah, so I think one of the things is that you can sometimes set up a piece of research and then go, okay, we've designed this now come and take part. But I think the process of co-design, so participatory research, is something that basically involves people from the start. And I think the two things that I think are really important, one is that it actually says there's real value in having these people's perspectives right from the start. I think the other thing it does is it helps you design research that is much more trauma-informed, much more person-centred, that uses language that is less likely to be less triggering. And you only learn that by sitting with people. And we actually, in the last project, asked those people to also look at our ethics form, so all the information we were going to send to people. And that really helped us to make sure that we were being inclusive in our language, that that we'd really thought through how to conduct the interview. So giving people a choice: do you want to be interviewed online, do you want to be interviewed somewhere near to you, somewhere near to us, somewhere entirely different. So I think it's hugely important. It's definitely what I would want to do moving forward. And actually, since that, we've started to do some work to take the domestic abuse work further across religions. And we had a focus group that involved a whole raft of co-designers to help us redesign the survey. So I think that is something that's hugely important.
What can you say about the settings in which this abuse happens? Because some people will be listening and they will have experienced this sort of abuse in a particular church setting. And I imagine that it can happen in any church setting, and yet I'm still interested in whether most of your respondents come from a particular flavour of church, as it were.
I think that's a really important question. And when I first started, I said I was reading books in America, and there was certainly a very strong suggestion there that this happened more in sort of charismatic or perhaps Pentecostal settings. However, that hasn't been the experience in the work that we've done. What we have found is experiences in across. Obviously, most of my work is in the Christian faith tradition, but across denominations, I think it can look different, and the way in which it might be perpetrated might be different, but we've certainly seen it across. I think one of the sort of dangers of seeing it in some places and not in others is that then people can think, well, it doesn't happen here and it always happens here. And so I used to say it can happen anywhere, but it doesn't happen everywhere.
I suppose when you've got a couple of very high-profile cases, as we have at the moment, the temptation then is to think that, you know, that's where it happens. You know, it happens in those sorts of churches with those sorts of leaders, and it doesn't happen in, you know, your little parish church down the road or your chapel or whatever it is.
I mean, I think that is an important question. I mean, I think those cases are really, really important. And I think what it should do is ask us to look at the dynamics that are happening there, to ask questions about leaders on pedestals, to ask questions about how ministry is operating, because I think that's hugely important, and there are definitely things to be learned. But I also think that the person who experiences this in their local parish church also has an experience of harm. And I think for me what it is about examining the dynamics everywhere. And one of the things we do in the work is we look at, well, how does power operate and the different ways in which power operates.
I mean, it raises so many questions about the culture of the organisation, doesn't it, of the training of ministers. And we're not saying that this is always perpetrated by ministers, but you know, by training, leadership models, all of it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the point about leaders. Certainly in the 2018 survey, a lot of leaders told us about their experiences of spiritual abuse. So I think what I always say is if we're going to tackle this, we need to tackle it in all the ways that it happens and recognise that leaders can and are spiritually abused themselves. But we also have done a lot of work recently looking at culture. So how do we create healthy cultures? Because culture is at the root of this. And also, if you create a culture in which you start to say it's okay to raise questions, it's okay to raise issues, then if somebody starts to tell you that it's not okay, there's a rub there, there's a difficulty. Whereas, so actually starting to unpack, what is the culture like? So one of the things we do is ask people, you know, what's in your soil? What's the kind of culture that you've got? And then to start to look at what are the hallmarks of some of the healthy cultures, which might include things like, you know, healthy accountability. So I talked earlier about enforced accountability, but not having any accountability at all is hugely problematic. And that's what we see in some of the cases recently. So we start to look at what are the hallmarks of a healthy culture. And so when we deliver spiritual abuse training now, based on the research that we've done, we talk about, well, what is it? What does it do to people? What's the impact of it? How do you respond well? That's really important. What have those who've experienced this told us about what the kind of responses that they need? And then how do we create healthy cultures so that in the future we would hope that we would have better prevention? Where harm does occur, we'd identify it much sooner and we'd respond much more effectively.
But what about the intersection of different forms of abuse? And I wonder almost whether we think there's a sort of hierarchy of abuse, that, you know, that the physical or the sexual is absolutely terrible, and the spiritual, well, it's just a little bit less damaging. And I wonder where you have a case where perhaps all three of those things happen, how important it is to address the spiritual abuse as part of that package of abuse.
I think it's really important. So certainly last year we did some work on domestic abuse in the Christian faith context, and we found that of those who'd experienced domestic abuse in that context, 60% said they'd experienced spiritual abuse as part of that. Often it is a hidden and unseen part of the harm that people are experiencing. But if you think about unpacking that just a little bit, if one of the, we asked people some of the teachings that perpetrators used either to justify abuse or to prevent people from leaving, and some of those teachings were things like teaching on marriage, teaching on submission of women, teaching on forgiveness. And so there we start to see just how important that overlap is.
It almost underpins it, doesn't it? It's the rationale for the other kind of abuse.
I think that when I watched the film Spotlight, there was a line in that said this wasn't just physical abuse, it was spiritual abuse. And I think it's really important to understand, because if you are a person of faith, it's deeply important to you. So if a rationale is presented to you for harm that is embedded within your faith, perhaps within your sacred text or within your cultural values, it's tremendously difficult. I remember one person saying to me, it's like you're arguing with God. So I think it is such an important thing. And when we do the training, we encourage people to think about if they are hearing an experience of domestic abuse or sexual abuse or financial abuse or physical abuse, is spiritual abuse part of that experience? Is it integrated into that experience? And that can be, as I say, a very hidden but a really important part of it.
I just want to raise the issue of Professor Alexa Jay's report into independent safeguarding in the Church of England, because she recommended not using the language of spiritual abuse, and you came out very robustly in defence of it. Were you surprised that she came out with that recommendation?
In one sense, I was, because obviously the focus of the report was on independence. I want to say there's some really important things in there. You know, I do agree with independent oversight, I think. But I think that I was surprised in some ways. I did write a response to that, because I think that taking away the language of spiritual abuse doesn't strengthen safeguarding. Actually, we've always said in the definition, this is a form of psychological and emotional abuse, but understanding how this form of psychological and emotional abuse is perpetrated, I think, can only help those who are seeking to identify harm. And so actually taking that language away takes away people's language to describe their own experiences and to understand them. But it also takes away some of the ability to identify the way in which that harm might be perpetrated. So for me, I don't think it is a helpful thing to do. I'm always open to, you know, do we need to do more work? Do we need to define this more clearly? Do we need to have more guidance? But certainly in the work that Task and Finish Group did in the Church of England over 7 years, and survivors were involved in that, there was a lot of work that went into kind of mapping out what is this, how is it perpetrated, what are the characteristics? And to me, to lose that would be to lose some really important information and actually to silence some experiences.
Final question. 21 years, how far has our understanding of spiritual abuse grown in that time, and how far have we still got to go?
Well, I hope it's grown some. I think it has. I think we've got a long way to go. I think certainly working with wonderful colleagues across faith traditions is helping us to expand that work more. I think there's a long way to go in understanding. But I think if I'd been doing a lecture 21 years ago, would you have come to do an interview? I'm not sure, because I don't think that it would even have been really talked about. So I think we have come a long way. And that's not just about my work. There's lots of people working in this area. And obviously what it's mostly about is those who've shared experiences, so that we've been able to learn more about what that is. So, you know, we have seen developments. You know, the Church of England currently does have a policy that includes spiritual abuse. The Methodist Church have a theology of safeguarding that talks about spiritual abuse. Somebody tweeted me last week that in Austria they're using our definition of spiritual abuse. So it definitely has come a long way. I think it's not a situation where you would always go somewhere and people would say, well, I don't know what that is. And people are using it to talk about their own experiences. But yeah, there's a long way to go.